Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Wheelock, Judge Flaskamp Halbrooks, the Honorable Kevin Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this Minnesota Court of Appeals oral argument of May 21, 2025. We have only one case left on our oral calendar today, and we're hearing it by interactive video and Zoom. And that matter is, I believe it's Volog or Volvog?
Kovalevog, Your Honor.
Kovalevog. Okay, I was wrong in both attempts. I apologize. I'm going to apologize beforehand because I'll probably mispronounce both parties' names throughout this proceeding, but Kovalevog versus Unke?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Very good. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument on behalf of your clients, with an additional 5 minutes for appellant to use for rebuttal if you'd like to. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions. They should be somewhere on your screen. There's a plane flying overhead and it's causing some noise, and I have an open window, so let me see if I can. There you go. Quiet it down a little bit.
At least it's warm enough down there to open windows. It's too cold up here in northern Minnesota.
You know, it's too warm in the building, so I'm probably violating some rule by opening a window. Each of you will have 15 minutes, five additional for appellant's counsel. Be mindful of those restrictions. They should be indicated in the clock on your screen somewhere. If in the event of our argument, either of you has any technical difficulties, either hearing or seeing any of the other parties, or the other party or members of the court, please just somehow bring it to our attention and we'll pause the proceedings so we can sort out the technology. Although we can see each other and we can see each other's names, we're only keeping an audio recording of the proceedings. So do state your name as you commence each leg of the argument for the benefit of the public later accessing the argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may do so.
Thank you. May I please court and counsel again. My name is Kevin Duffy. I'm counsel for the appellant, Raymond Kovalevog, in this matter. In July of 2023, Mr. Kovalevog brought this a claim of legal malpractice against his former attorney, Garth Unke, in his law firm. In early 2024, the parties then brought motions for summary judgment. Defendants claimed that Kovalevog could not prove compensable damages, and Kovalevog, on his part, basically claimed that he was entitled to summary judgment based on liability issues, and also that Mr. Unke had breached his fiduciary duty to him. A hearing was held on April 26th before the District Court Judge Miller, and he eventually entered an order granting summary judgment to the respondents and denying Mr. Kovalevog's motion for summary judgment. And an order was entered July 17th, 2024, and this appeal followed thereafter. The underlying general facts, I'll be really quick on this, is that on June 23rd, 2020.
If you'd like to go over the facts, you certainly can, but you should be aware that the court has had an opportunity to review all the briefing and any portions of the record that are relevant. You can use your time however you'd like.
Okay, super. Then I will move ahead then. Basically, in this particular matter, when the order was entered, the judge reviewed basically whether there was any damages from Kovalevog's standpoint related to Unke's negligent misrepresentation. And the court, district court, ruled six types of harm to Kovalevog. The payment which was made to Mr. Schwamp by the insurance carrier for Mr. Kovalevog.
You said negligent misrepresentation. I'm assuming you mean negligent representation.
Negligent representation, correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Right.
Also, the loss of ability to defend the Swant claim, the loss of ability to maintain a cross claim related to the accidents and counterclaim, the loss of a claim not involving the accident itself, a loss of ability to conduct scheduled and court ordered depositions, and lastly, the increased insurance premiums. It's our position that Kovalevog did suffer harm from the breach of fiduciary duty. We cited to the court the Blum case, where it was a case involving minority shareholders, where there was a breach of fiduciary duty. And even though there were not damages proved, it was clear that it was determined that damages could be measured by the amount of gain from the breach of the fiduciary duty. And it's our belief, Your Honors, that in this particular case, the fiduciary duty in that case, even though it applied to minority shareholders, the specifics are a little bit different here, but there's still a breach of fiduciary duty involving Mr. Unke and Mr.
Counsel, was that claim forfeited though by Mr. Kovalbog when he proceeded on a legal malpractice claim instead and didn't assert the breach of fiduciary duty claim?
Well, we did address that, Your Honor, later on in our response brief. I think you're relating to the claim by the respondents that Mr. Kovalbog never asserted a claim of breach of fiduciary duty. Is that what you're referring to? And we did cite to the court the Halva case and our position that Minnesota is a notice pleading state and that the plaintiffs can plead their case by way of broad general statements. And absolute specificity is not necessarily necessary, rather information sufficient to fairly notify the other opposing party against it that is satisfactory. And we believe that we would submit to the, your honors that there's sufficient facts stated in the complaint of Mr. Kovalbog to create that breach of fiduciary duty, even though it's not specifically alleged by him in the pleadings that he submitted to this court.
What is the language in the pleading that would have put Mr. Unke on notice that that is a claim?
I don't have the exact complaint right in front of me, but I know that he detailed specific actions of what took place. He detailed how.
Well, I understand. I mean, we can see the actions. I'm just trying to get a sense of.
Right.
I mean, notice pleading. There has to be notice of the thing that's being pleaded. And
right.
So, As I understand it, as we usually treat notice pleading, you at least have to say you're making this claim under some theory of law, even if you don't have to be specific,
right.
More specific than that. So what is the language in the complaint that most clearly, or the answer that most clearly establishes a breach of fiduciary duty claim?
Again, I don't have the complaint right in front of Your Honor. I apologize for that.
Off the top of your head, what is
off the top of my head, the claim that Mr. Kovalbog...
We were going to pepper you with questions like this. I'm sure you took a look and you can recall as best you can.
Sure. But the best I can recall, there is a claim that Mr. Unke and Mr. Kovalbog went into mediation, obviously with Mr. Unke representing Mr. Kovalbog, and his claim that they went in there with the understanding that the mediation was not going to be settled unless the depositions were maintained. And that then he details how he was basically abandoned by Mr. Unke during the mediation and kept totally left out in the blue basically all day long, and that eventually came back and the case was actually settled without any input from him and obviously totally against what they had agreed to previously before coming into the mediation that it would not be settled. So he was relying upon the loyalty that he anticipated that he would receive from Mr. Unke and representing his interests that didn't happen. And I think that should, in our opinion, should be sufficient. Hopefully the court finds it sufficient, but that was our belief or position with respect to that and giving notice that what he went into the mediation expecting, what they had agreed upon, and then the violation of that expectation, that loyalty by Mr. Unke just simply abandoning the plan of attack that they basically had when they went in there. I think Mr. Kovalbog used the phrase, we are all in unistep or whatever with each other. We had the same plan, what we're going to do. And when we went in there, Mr. Unke unilaterally just went away from the plan and did what he wanted to do, irrespective of what the interests of Mr. Kovalbog were. And that,
So on the other basis for your appeal beyond fiduciary duty payments,
sure.
I'm curious about your argument that your client suffered harm based upon what you described as the excessive payment to Mr. Schwant. And are you focusing on the nominal damages?
So what I'm focusing on the nominal damages, Judge, but there's a variation of that. What Mr. Koala, if he would have been advised of his right to withdraw from the coverage, okay, if that would have happened, he would have been rightfully advised by Mr. Unke of that right. He would have withdrawn from the coverage. He would have been on his own. And then he could have gone and individually fought Mr. Schwant. And I know it goes way deeper in the case than you've probably gone into, but my client's claim by Mr. Schwant is that the claim was totally fraudulent. And I think Mr. Unke definitely agreed with that it was fraudulent because he was claimed to have been totally injured and bedridden, and he was water skiing 3 weeks later, from the time that he claimed he was injured.
I could just procedurally focusing on your claim for nominal damages. Let's assume we can break those apart from
Right.
any further substance. When was that raised in the district court?
As far as
Nominal the nominal damages were part of your claim for damage. The district court said there was no damages, therefore summary judgment. And I'm
correct.
wondering when your client presented to the district court this theory that you're raising on appeal with regard to nominal damages.
And you're totally right. That is a topic that was brought up by counsel with respect to that. And we did deal with that. We acknowledged that the nominal damage claim was not brought before the district court, and we acknowledged that failure by Mr. Qualbaugh, who was obviously representing himself, and that's not an excuse, but that it happened. But we also then cited to you, Judge, the Blakely case, where basically the court has the authority to take action as the interests of justice require. And when you have an appeal where something was not brought up at the district court, but is plainly decisive on the controversy on the merits, that it can be considered by the court on appeal. And so we believe that nominal damages were implicit in the fiduciary duty claim that was cited by Mr. Qualbaugh. No new facts were required to make a determination that damages could be awarded, and they've basically argued about those facts at the lower court level. And so, our request would hopefully be that the court would take that authority to deal with that issue here on appeal, given those circumstances. And the other thing that we did cite, Judge, that I figured that you'd ask me about is those series of Pearl cases studied by the Minnesota Supreme Court, where there's basically a discussion of the breach of fiduciary duty and how when there is a breach and there's no evidence of damages, that there can actually be a forfeiture, a fee forfeiture involved, even though there is no damages shown. And I know counsel for Mr. Unke has argued that, well, Mr. Duffy, how can you argue that? Because Mr. Qualbaugh didn't pay Mr. Unke. The insurance company paid Mr. Unke. But I think our position there, judges, is that those Pearl cases show that there's clearly a means and a theory that you can pay and award fee forfeiture when there are just nominal damages involved, such as we've argued in this case.
And
And
again,
specifically, yes.
for us to reach that issue, we would have to do so based upon an interest of justice exception because this all too was not raised in the district court. Am I correct?
You're totally correct, Your Honor. I'm not going to try to dance around that. But the point is that the other point that was made by counsel for Mr. Unke is that, well, how can you, Mr. Duffy, how can you argue that because Mr. Qualbaugh did not pay any fees to Mr. Unke? And that's true. But we've argued in our brief that we believe that the fees to be forfeited would be the fees paid by the insurance company to Mr. Unke. Because if you look at those Pearl cases, they talk about breaching that duty and the nominal damages that can be awarded with fee forfeiture. If you had that equitable right that Pearl talks about, but then you have no way to award any damages, it just makes that right kind of inequitable. The only equitable way to twist that around or to interpret that would be to say, well, there is fees. It's just that they weren't paid by Mr. Qualbaugh. They were paid by the insurance company to Mr. Unke, and that those would be the fees that would be forfeited in this particular action.
Mr.
One
Duffy,
last, yes.
just following up on the Pearl series of cases, I mean, aren't those quite distinguishable? Because in that instance, Mr. Pearl had an arrangement with an insurance company to bring certain types of claims. And so he was deriving personal benefit from this fraudulent arrangement that he had. And that seemed to be the thing
Right.
that was the fundamental problem with those cases.
True.
I mean, we have nothing comparable to that here.
No, but I mean, You still have the, I still think the with all due respect, I get that point, but with the point I would make there is that you still have got this, the primary thrust of that being a breach of a fiduciary duty and harm being caused. And we've detailed in the brief the harm that was caused to Mr. Qualvaugh in this particular case. And we feel that even though taking your point there, that it still could be comparable, and the argument still can be made with respect to the fee forfeiture there. I'm running too low on time, but one of the last points I wanted to make here, judges, your honors, is this, is that one of the big mistakes I think was made at the lower court level is that Judge Miller jumped on what Judge Morley had done in deciding the Schwant case, and then this malpractice case. And what they said was everything flew off of Judge Morley said, well, the insurance company has the legal right and authority to settle this case, and they did. And therefore, because they did it on a Perringer basis, there's no more claims going back and forth. And so, Mr. Qualvaugh, these depositions you wanted, these counterclaims you want, all that stuff is taken care of because of this settlement and these Perringer releases. And the fact is that's in our position is that's not the crux of this case, Your Honors. What happened is the damages to Qualvaugh are not the result that are the result of the settlement being allowed. The district court and the Schwant case before that, their damages and their decision is all based upon the fact that the case was properly settled, and the way it handled it was properly settled. But for the malpractice by Mr. Unke, if he would have told Mr. Qualvaugh, you can get out of this thing, and if you get out of it, there will be no settlement. And if there's no settlement, there can't everything else doesn't flow from it. So he would have still kept his depositions. He still would have been able to defend his lawsuit. But Judge Miller and Judge Morley in that case said, "Oh, the settlement's done. You can't argue about it. Too bad. So sad." And so, no depositions, no counterclaims, no cross claims, and everything goes from there. And Qualvaugh is our. We've argued, Your Honors. And if I can, I got my time is out here. Can I go just a few more seconds?
You can close your thought with yes.
Okay. And so the point by Mr. Qualvaugh is this. He said, because of the negligence of Mr. Unke, the settlement went through. If he would have done his job and been loyal to me, the settlement, he would have told me to get out of this thing, and I would have objected. There would have been no settlement. And then the damages that I'm talking about would be there. And the way the case was decided, I agree. He doesn't have the damages because the deposit, I would agree with the district judge said, well, there's no more claims, so there's no need for depositions. But there are needs for depositions, and there were needs for depositions. And if the settlement would not have gone through, the various claims of damage by him would have existed and would have been there.
Thank you,
Thank
Mr.
you very
Duffy.
much.
You will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal if you like.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Chris Angel, and it is my honor and privilege to be here today, virtually anyway, representing Garth Unke and the Stitch Angel, Kreidler, and Unke law firm. Just in the event the court was curious or counsel was curious, there is no relation between me and the Stitch, even though my name is Chris Angel, I am not related to anybody at the Stitch Angel law firm, although I think John Angel had 9 kids or something, and so I get asked that frequently. But
I'm going to pause you just for a moment. I want to make sure we haven't lost counsel. Mr. Duffy, are you still with us?
I'm
If you
still
could,
here.
Marshall could pause the clock for us since I'm interrupting. All right, I just wanted you disappeared, and I want to make sure if you stay on screen, then we'll know that you're when you disappear. I assume that you're now lost somewhere in the dark space of the internet or the cloud. I don't know what the cloud is, but I wouldn't want you to have to be there
Thank
alone.
you. Thank you, Judge. Appreciate
So,
that.
all right. Sorry, Mr. Angel, if you could, whoops, I'm sorry. Marshall, if you could add another minute to Mr. Angel's time since I've cut into it. The clock is still running.
I'm sorry, there's an alarm going off that I'm trying to turn off, but I've paused it.
All right. I think I'm going to be able to finish my comments in the time that I have allowed.
Thank you, Mr. Angel. Sorry for the
I
interruption.
will be brief, and I will take my cues from the court. I had a long presentation that I plan to make today, including going over the facts, because you never know whether you need to do that. I understand the court has read the briefs, so I'm going to skip over that part and kind of jump to what I think are the important things that I need to talk about with the court today. And I will get to, as part of my presentation, some of the things that Mr. Duffy said. But before I go forward, are there any specific questions that the court wants me to address right at the outset?
Doesn't appear so.
Okay.
We'll wait till you get in your argument so we can take you off track. That's what we do.
Fair enough. The court is familiar with the posture of the case. The claim was a claim for legal malpractice to the district court. It was pled as a claim for legal malpractice. Again, I will get to that in just a moment, Your Honor. I was prepared to show you the complaint, and I will. Just give me a second. The basis for the motion was a claim for legal malpractice requires, as one of its essential elements, elements of damages. Now, we certainly didn't concede anything on the liability side, but from our perspective, it didn't matter because Mr. Kovalevog didn't submit any evidence of compensable damages. And of course, that's how the matter was briefed below. That's how the judge ended up coming down on it. I know this court has kind of touched on some of the same issues in other cases involving Mr. Kovalevog, in which the court had to kind of evaluate the same thing. And I'm talking about this court's decision affirming Judge Morley's denial of Mr. Unke's motion to stay the settlement on the grounds that, among other things, Mr. Unke didn't suffer any harm. We've made the collateral estoppel argument as part of our brief.
Mr. Unke didn't suffer any harm?
I'm sorry, Mr. Kovalevog, I misspoke. My apologies. His principle, and he has essentially, for the most part, I think it's fair to say that Mr. Kovalevog has abandoned the argument that he made to the trial court, which was, wait a minute, I do have a claim for malpractice, and here are my damages. He has all but abandoned that on appeal, the one exception being his insurance premium argument, which I will address in just a moment. Instead, on appeal, the principal argument is, I don't need to sell any damages because Mr. Unke's conduct amounts to a breach of fiduciary duty, and a breach of fiduciary duty doesn't require any actual damages, and so therefore Judge Miller erred. I mean, that's the gist of what this appeal is about.
Well, there's also the argument that other elements of the claim survive based upon a nominal damages theory, even if there are no substantive damages.
That's right, and I believe, Your Honor, that the nominal damage theory that is being advanced, Your Honor, is based on the String of Pearls cases. And the String of Pearls cases was based on a breach of fiduciary duty claim. As I understand it, and Mr. Duffy can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Mr. Duffy's argument is that because I have a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, or because Mr. Kovalevog has a claim for fiduciary duty, and nominal damages are awarded for a breach of fiduciary duty, even if there are no actual damages, that's why we win. I believe that's the argument that's being advanced. And all of that is, as the court has noted, brand new. None of that stuff was submitted to the district court. I'd like to, before I get to that, if I could just address very quickly the insurance premium argument, because that is the one argument that Mr. Kovalevog made below that he has continued to make here in front of the Court of Appeals. He is arguing that I was damaged in the form of increased insurance premiums and by the amount of time that an effort that I had to spend to find new insurance. Two responses, and I will be brief. The time to make that argument and submit evidence that Mr. Kovalevog's Secura dropped Mr. Kovalevog's insurance as a result of the settlement, and now Mr. Kovalevog has to pay X dollars more than he used to pay, the time to present that evidence, Your Honor, was at the trial court in response to the summary judgment motion. He didn't do any of that. I won't go through all of the record. Your court certainly has it, but I think if Your Honor reviews it, you'll see that there is no evidence about increased insurance premiums other than Mr. Kovalevog's belief, which he set forth in an affidavit and his brief, his belief that Secura dropped his insurance because of the settlement. That's it. That's all that we have. That is not evidence. And so even if increased insurance premiums and the like were recoverable as a damage for malpractice, he didn't present any evidence of it. And even if he had presented evidence of it, Your Honor, we have cited cases. I have looked high and low across the country, and I cited them in my brief, cases across the country. I can find no state that has held that a tortfeasor, that part of a tortfeasor's liability is an increase in the plaintiff's insurance premiums. I cited a Minnesota case, Northern States Contracting versus Oaks. I cited cases from other jurisdictions that hold the same thing. Mr. Kvalvaag hasn't cited any cases that say that a tortfeasor's liability includes the plaintiff's increase in insurance premiums. He cited a couple of cases, Wilmington Trust National Association and Hennepin Holdings, which did not even consider the issue at all. If your honor reads the case, you will see that it simply mentioned in passing that an arbitrator had awarded a tenant damages for increased insurance premiums. Now, I don't know, that was a contract case. I don't know why the arbitrator did it. And the court's focus wasn't on that. And it was simply a passing reference in that case. Wilmington certainly does not stand for the proposition that a tortfeasor's liability includes increased insurance premiums. Another case that he cites is Collins versus EMC Insurance Company.
I'm sorry, Mr. Angel, is there a reason, okay, as a matter of law, why increased insurance premiums would not be damages if, in fact, that is a result, the consequence of alleged malpractice or other negligent conduct?
Yes, it's a foreseeability issue. And the cases that we have cited in our brief discuss it as such. It is a situation where courts have decided as a matter of law that increased insurance premiums are not foreseeable to a tortfeasor and therefore are not part of the damages for which a tortfeasor can be held liable. And again, this isn't anything that I'm saying. This is what the cases say.
And there's no Minnesota law on the question.
There is. I cited a Minnesota case, Northern States Contracting Company versus Oak.
Okay. Yeah, sorry.
In our brief, that stands for that proposition. I don't know that there's any other Minnesota cases that are directly on point. But again, there's certainly cases from other jurisdictions. And more importantly, there isn't any case that I'm aware of, any Minnesota case, that controverts what Northern States Contracting said. With your honor's permission, I'd like to move to the big issue, which the big issue is, I think, the breach of fiduciary duty claim. Because I think, like I said, it appears to me that Mr. Kvalvaag has all but waved the white flag on...
counsel, is it your intention to address the interests of justice here?
Yes, I will. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to do it right now. Before I get to the substance of the breach of fiduciary duty claim, I don't mean to sound indignant because I'm really not, okay? But I think it's important. My firm and I took the proceedings in front of the trial court seriously. We took it no less seriously than I'm taking this proceeding in front of this court today. Judge Miller and his staff took it seriously. Judge Miller and his staff reviewed voluminous submissions. They heard oral argument. Judge Miller took the time to write a detailed 21-page order. And the time for Kvalvaag, respectfully, the time for Mr. Kvalvaag to present arguments and evidence in opposition to our summary judgment motion was in front of Judge Miller. At the trial court level, it's not to do it here. And of course, the reason why the law is such that people are required to make their arguments to the district court is so that Judge Miller could consider and rule upon those arguments. Okay, this court is an error correcting court. It is not this court's function to consider and rule upon arguments that were never made to the district court, and nor should it be, I would submit. How can this court conclude that Judge Miller erred based on arguments that were never made to Judge Miller? To permit Mr. Kvalvaag to essentially treat this appeal as an opportunity to make arguments that he never made to Judge Miller, to effectively have a do-over. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be indignant, but I think it cheapens the import of the trial court proceedings and the hard work that everybody else including Judge Miller and his staff, put into the summary judge motion. So I don't know if that adequately addresses your interests of justice question, but I think it's clear that in my view, the interests of justice mandate doing the opposite of what Mr. Kvalvaag is asking the court to do. The interests of justice support not considering Mr. Kvalvaag.
Well, sometimes, I mean, that's the framing or the procedural setting in which we're asked to consider the interest of justice. That is, the interest of justice exception is for, I think, the circumstance that you're raising, which is an argument wasn't presented. Should this court consider it anyway? Even though the district court didn't.
And I don't think the court. Sorry, Judge. I didn't interrupt. Go ahead.
So the question is, are there circumstances in this case where we would make an exception to our usual forfeiture remedy?
In my view, no. In my view, no, there isn't any facts that would suggest that this court should exercise its discretion to hear arguments and consider arguments that were never made to Judge Miller. No, I don't think there's any interest of justice that requires that. I don't think there's any fact about this case that supports the court doing that. I know I'm getting close to the end of my time, so I want to hit these final points if I can. I told you that I would get to the question that the court asked about the complaint. I have the complaint in front of me. I was prepared to answer that question about whether the complaint says, duty of care. Garthunke breached that standard of care as a direct result of Garthunke's breaches of the standard of care. It mentions the standard of care over and over again in count one, and never once does it mention the standard of conduct. And as this court is aware, the distinction between a legal malpractice claim and a claim for breach of fiduciary duty is a legal malpractice claim is based upon a standard of care. A breach of fiduciary duty claim is based on a standard of conduct. But setting this aside for the moment, whether or not this complaint adequately pled a claim of breach of fiduciary duty under the notice pleading standard, what difference does that make with respect to whether or not Mr. Kvalvaag was required to make that argument in response to the summary judgment motion? Clearly, when Mr. Kvalvaag received our papers, he knew that we were operating under the conception that the only claim that he was making was a claim for legal malpractice. If it was his contention that, no, I've also pled a claim of breach of fiduciary duty, and that's why you should deny summary judgment, that was an argument he needed to make to Judge Miller, regardless of whether or not he thinks that the notice that his claim, that his complaint under the notice pleading standard pled a claim of breach of fiduciary duty. One more important point, I've addressed the string of pearls cases. I read them in prep and reread them in preparation of this argument. The court knows in general that those cases provide that where there's a breach of fiduciary duty and no actual damages, a client can recover nominal damages in the form of a fee forfeiture. Two things in response. I've already addressed in my brief the issue that Mr. Kvalvaag didn't pay any fees. The string of pearls cases certainly does not contemplate awarding fees to a client that never paid any. There isn't any cases directly on point, but I think the case that's the closest is the case that Mr. Kvalvaag cited in his brief, which is Commercial Associates Inc. versus Work Connection Inc. And in that case, you had it was a breach of fiduciary duty claim against an insurance agency. And the plaintiff was seeking to recover not only the premiums that he had paid to the insurance agency, but also commissions that a third-party broker had paid to the insurance agency. And this court held in that case that string of pearls doesn't extend to the commissions made by a third payments made by a third party. And I, again, Your Honor, I wish I had a case that was closer on point, but that's the best I can give you that has addressed the case in Minnesota. I respectfully submit there's no reason to treat this case any differently. Last point, the gripe of
this. Do make it very quick. Your time has expired.
I will. The gripe here is that Mr. Unke, it's not that he didn't prevent the settlement of the case. Secura had the right to settle the case. They had the exclusive right to settle the case. The gripe is that Mr. Unke didn't advise Mr. Kovalvaag of his right to withdraw tender of the defense to Secura, and that had Mr. Unke advised him of that right, Mr. Kovalvaag would have withdrawn tender of defense from Secura. Thereby, Secura wouldn't have this exclusive authority to settle the case because the tender would be withdrawn. That's his gripe, and that is not a breach of fiduciary duty. That breach of fiduciary duty, loyalty, confidentiality, candor, that is a, if anything, a breach of the duty of care. So
thank you,
that's
Mr.
all that I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal? Before you begin, I'll ask the marshal to add it. I did extend Mr. Angel's time about a minute. If you can give Mr. Duffy 6 minutes rather than five for rebuttal. I'll let the marshal reset the clock. All right. Mr. Duffy, any rebuttal, Mr. Duffy?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, again, Kevin Duffy on behalf of the appellant, Raymond Qualbug, here on my rebuttal. Just a couple of things. Obviously, just in a nutshell, I would just stay on the record that Mr. Qualbug, obviously, as an appellant here, feels that his rights are basically gone based upon the actions or inactions of his counsel at the time, Mr. Unke. All I'm going to say with respect to the settlement of the case, Mr. Angel says it right. Yeah, the insurance company clearly had the right to settle this case under the policy. And the rub is that Mr. Unke did not tell Mr. Qualbaugh that you have the right to withdraw from that representation and that coverage, and all of the different rights he's talking about would be there. And so to try to argue with a straight face that there's nothing wrong with that, it's not a breach of loyalty, a breach of any kind of duty, I think it's pretty self-evident. I'm not going to go any further than that.
I was wrong when I asked Mr. Angel the question. I thought he only cited other jurisdictions, but he did, in fact, cite Northern States Contracting for the proposition that increased insurance premiums are too remote to form the basis of damages. You didn't reply in your reply brief. You didn't address the Northern States Contracting case. Were you able to find any case in Minnesota?
No, I did not. But the thing that I would reference the court to is in our brief, we talked about the fact that district court reject our opinion positions that the district court rejected Qualbaugh's claims on the insurance because he merely stated he had suffered a loss or increased premiums and didn't provide a damage amount. And then we cited to the court the Olson versus Aretz case, and it's our belief or position that basically when it comes to the summary judgment stage, that specific numbers are not required. There's no such requirement that exists. He claims that he suffered from the increased premiums and that he would later prove the exact amount later at a trial. The other point that we made or argument we made was that an increase in insurance premium and even a cancellation of coverage is a foreseeable consequence of a substantial settlement. Claims history is an element that insurance coverage decisions and premiums are based upon. And we cited the EEP Workers' Comp Fund case to the court, talking about claims histories as a factor in determining premiums.
But you weren't able to find any case that rebuts the Northern States holding about insurance premium increases being too remote.
To be honest with you,
your brief doesn't attempt to distinguish Northern States.
I was not, Your Honor. It did not have that. So, and basically, those are the only comments I've got with respect to rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your appearance today, for your briefing in the matter. We appreciate it. We will take the matter under advisement. We will issue opinion within our statutory period. Thank you both for appearing. Thanks and have a very nice day.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You do the same. Thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.